them a map, and they decided that they would use their trusty cell phones and the compass app on it to find their way. Now, as it turns out, if you had paid close attention to the map that they had, it wasn't very detailed, meaning they could see the trail they were supposed to be on, but if for any reason they fell off that trail and took another way, they wouldn't be able to use the map to find their way back. And now, as they went for about 2 miles into their hike, and without realizing it at first, after having to cross over an open granite slab, something very common in Yosemite National Park, they got off trail. But they were determined to find their way after they kind of recognized they weren't where they should be. And like every inexperienced hiker, their impulse was to just keep going. Eventually, they were in a wooded area where it was impossible to make out any nearby landmarks that might have rendered that map actually useful to figure out at least an approximate off-trail location. To make matters worse, and maybe you anticipated this problem, in the middle of the woods in a national park, their cell phones didn't get service. So that compass app did nothing. But they decided, as all good inexperienced hikers do, to just keep going for another 3 hours. They debated at one point between scrambling up to get a higher vantage point or maybe hiking down to Yosemite Creek. Their plan kind of changed frequently, you know, up, down, and up and down. As time passed, they realized they weren't getting any closer to finding the trail, and they became increasingly concerned. While I have no way of knowing for sure, I believe we were just going in circles, one of the backpackers later said. Now, eventually, to their luck, they spotted another hiker some distance away from them, and they assumed that that hiker was actually on the right trail, and fortunate for them, they were correct. And so they found their way back to the trail. The hiker was able to tell them where to go and how to stay on the trailhead. And so eventually, many hours after their anticipated arrival, they made it to their planned destination. Now, park rangers love to remind hikers to always bring and also know how to use an accurate and detailed topographic map. And in addition to that, as wonderful as all our smartphones are, to bring one of those good old-fashioned magnetic compasses. With a compass, you can figure out where north is, helps you to orient your map, and that way, even if you get off trail, you can find your way back to the right place. It seems that the ability to know the right direction that you should be going and whether or not you are on the right path is the difference between having a great adventure and being lost in the woods. And I think that this is a worthwhile image for us to consider as we talk about Jesus' experience in the wilderness. See, following his baptism in the Jordan River, Jesus is, Matthew tells us, led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. The temptation comes at the end of a period of fasting for Jesus that lasts 40 days and 40 nights. Jesus is physically and emotionally and spiritually weak, and that's when the great tempter comes to test his resolve. And there's three temptations given to you each in turn, right? So you go back, you look at the text, the first one is Satan tempts Jesus to turn rocks into loaves of bread. Well, I don't care how hungry Jesus is, he doesn't need 20 loaves of bread, right? These loaves of bread that he's being tempted, they're not actually for him. They're for others. It's a way of thinking about how crowds of people may love you if you can provide even the simplest food for them. The Emperor Augustus knew this very well. He knew that if he could keep the poor masses happy enough and reasonably well fed, that they wouldn't riot against him. So he instituted these free grain policies and kept certain market prices low. He would also put on lots of great free entertainment, like chariot races and gladiator matches, right? As one writer famously put it, the system of bribery was a policy of bread and circuses. The temptation for Jesus here is the same. Imagine the influence that you can have over people if you become the guy who's responsible for the free bread. Certainly, if you can turn stones into bread, you can offer better entertainment than just circuses. Jesus, don't you want to be popular? Don't you want to be loved? Don't you want to be greater than the emperor? This is the first temptation. And the second temptation follows a similar line of thinking. Jesus is taken to the top of the holy temple in Jerusalem. Now we find later in the New Testament, Jesus is referred to as the great high priest. He earns this title as a mediator between God and humans because of his self-sacrifice, because of his great love. He earns this ability to mediate between God and humanity. And the temptation here is to say, yeah, but this current path that you're on, it involves a lot of suffering and pain and self-sacrifice, putting others ahead of yourself. That all seems not very fun. So how about this? How about you skip all the pain, all the sacrifice, all the uncomfortability, and just jump straight to glory? Right? Let's do that, Jesus. Wouldn't you want a pain-free life? An easy life. But as Jesus knows, not a good one. This is the second temptation. So then we get to the third. Jesus, wouldn't you like to rule all the kingdoms of the earth? For people in Jesus' location in this time of the world, again, this goes back to the person who runs the world is the Roman Emperor, but Jesus, you can have that power if you just decide to take it. After all, that's how any dictator, emperor, ruler of any part of history does it. You take it by force. Might makes right, Jesus. So look, I will just take it from him and give it to you, and you can be just like every other leader. Great and powerful and revered, and they'll build statues for you. What do you say? Woo people with bread and circuses. Skip pain and jump straight to glory. Rule the world with an iron fist. These are Satan's temptations to Jesus. All of which describe a pretty significant detour from the path Jesus is supposed to be on. Right? Jesus will feed the hungry. He will clothe the naked, but he won't do it for personal gain. Jesus will seek to rebuild relationships between God and humans, but he won't do it through spectacles and displays. He'll do it by welcoming in the outcast and welcoming people who don't feel good enough. Jesus will become the king of the world, but not through more violence and more aggression. Jesus is tempted to get lost in the woods of quick fixes, good enoughs, and instant gratification. But if Jesus is to become the person he was created to be, the person God wants him to be, then he must keep his eyes focused on true north, on God's plan for his life. And I think that that is a worthwhile thing for us to think about as people here, right? I mean, how do we have a sense of our own true north in our lives, of who God has created us to be and what God has created us to do, and how we go about living into that full potential? Do we trust God to provide us the right map and the right compass point? That's really the fundamental question at the beginning of that Genesis passage that we read earlier. And there's lots of terrible commentary on this. Just a couple things for you to note. First, the snake tempts both the man and the woman. This isn't a story about how Eve took the fruit mistakenly. Adam's there and just as guilty too. It's about humanity. These two figures, Adam and Eve, standing in place for that. But it's about how we as humans can often mistrust that God has our best intentions in mind. That God actually wants good things for us. That's really the serpent's temptation. Right? You can't trust God. You can't trust that God wants good things for you. So you've got to take matters into your own hands. And if you don't, who knows what will happen to you? Jesus models a very different way of what it looks like to trust, of what it looks like to believe that God wants us to discover meaning and purpose, joy and fulfillment, that the path to the good life may not be easy, but it is one that leads to life and life to the full. The question for each of us here today is, do we believe that God has our best intentions in mind, that God really does want us to have lives full of meaning and fulfillment? And I guess related to that, then, do we feel like we're living into that full potential? For me, I feel like I'm trying, but I'm not there yet. I haven't arrived, right? Most of my sermons on Sunday are me trying to work out with you about what this all means. But I do trust that God has joy and purpose, meaning and fulfillment awaiting. And so as we begin this Lenten journey, one of the practices that the church mothers and fathers always called us to, that is filled throughout the Bible, that was central to Jesus' own life and ministry, is spending time in prayer. Now, prayer is a time for us to listen to God's leading in our lives, to develop our connection. It helps us to know the right direction we should be going and whether or not we're on the right path. Henry Nouwen once said that prayer is not about getting answers to my questions. It's about learning to live in the presence of God. That's the hard part about it. Prayer is not about true prayer. Genuine prayer is not about quick fixes. It's not about getting instant gratification. It's about becoming somebody different. It's about being transformed. It happens slowly and over time. You don't pray once and you've achieved enlightenment, and that's it. And you never have another worry, concern, stress in your life. It's a process we return back to. Like a hiker on a long trip, we have to constantly orient and reorient ourselves back to true north. And so this week, in our book from Adam Hamilton, it opens up with a passage about worship and prayer. And each week, Hamilton ends with a challenge for us to practice in our spiritual lives, right? So the one he has this week is learning to pray 5 times a day. Right? He uses his fingers a lot when you go through this. Lots of mnemonic devices. Right? But he says, you pray once when you wake up. You've got 3 meals. You pray once at each of those, and then once before you go to sleep. and you've hit your five. Right? All of a sudden, it's a little bit more manageable. Now, these don't have to be long-winded prayers, but they are moments in which we center ourselves. We try to develop our awareness that God is present and active in our lives and bring ourselves back to true north in the rhythms of our day. And so I want to invite you this week to try this. Right? Try this with me. If you already are someone who has this rhythm, that's wonderful. What are ways that you might renew it or refocus that commitment? If you don't currently pray five times a day, how can you start? How can you try? Right? When will you pray? Where will you pray? You know, it's not just the time of day, but is there a chair you're going to sit in? Is there a walk you'll be on? The goal of all this is not that by the end of the week you'll have all the answers to the mysteries of the universe, that whatever you're going through will miraculously be solved. It will simply be that we will cultivate a sense of God's presence, that we might try to continually to orient our lives to the lifestyle of grace and mercy that Christ calls us to. For that's the meaning of our worship today, of this next symbol that we come to, this symbol of the table. This table actually